even in architecture, you can still have people who fantasize about avoiding or escaping the user, you know, by bolting everything to the floor, literally, or making models instead of actual buildings, right? In games, the thing that interests me the most, in games, the problem is constantly there. In a very literal sense, you can't, like, it doesn't make any sense to produce a fantasy where you don't have to, you know, to think about who's going to be playing. It's hard to say what that would even entail.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to BungaCast, the global politics podcast at the end of the end of history. I'm Alex Hochuli in Sao Paulo, Brazil, as per usual, joined by fellow Bunga boy, George Hoare, in London. Hello, George.
Hey.
And we are very happy to welcome today Paweł Kaczmarski, who is a literary critic. He teaches modern and contemporary Polish literature at the University of Wrocław, and has written two books about Polish poetry, which is unfortunately a topic we're not going to get onto. Those books are also in Polish. So I wasn't able to prepare enough, basically, for that. So we're going to have to skip that element of today's episode. Instead, what we're going to mainly focus on is an article that Paweł has written for Damage. It's come out on the 1st of April, called The Promise of Video Games. And that'll be a question we'll be inquiring into. I'm just going to cite from it here. Helldivers 2 uses the video game form to raise fundamental questions about agency and intention. Unfortunately, like so much of the culture industry, it ultimately comprises its core message for the typical rewards of the entertainment industry.
Compromises its core message.
Well, what did I say?
You said comprises.
Oh, yeah, no, that compromises makes a lot more sense. It ultimately compromises its core message for the typical rewards of the entertainment industry. So we didn't get the fundamental questions about agency and intention. Instead, we got the usual entertainment industry bullshit. You got that, mate? Got that clear? Okay, good. Well done, Alex. We're going to continue this very professionally. Anyway, hi, Paweł. How's it going?
Hi, very good. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah. So, yeah, I want to ask you, like, how things are going in Poland, and to make that maybe a little bit more specific of a question, there's elections coming up at the end of May, right? So how's that playing out? Are you getting loads of campaign literature through your letterbox? Are there people campaigning on the streets, or are people not very interested in the election?
I think they are sort of to a point. I think the mood just in general is quite pessimistic, but also quite intense in places. It's kind of hard to say. I feel like, you know, in general, we're maybe doing better than some of our neighbors, at least, but still not great. And during this particular election campaign, the three main candidates are basically sort of outbidding one another on who's the most business friendly and hates taxes the most. So for someone on the left, it's really not, like, you know, it's sort of hard to get invested. Whoever wins, it's pretty much going to be almost the same. I mean, the far right candidates is clearly worse than the other two, but the core message of all of them is surprisingly similar. And the people to the left of the center have like a combined 12% in the polls. So right. Yeah.
So I should ask this as well. I mean, unfortunately, we're probably having to ask everyone this on the podcast, at least for these early months of 2025, which is, what's the reception to Trump been like in Poland? Because I mean, I think the Polish right were obviously very pro-Trump, but then he goes and blames Ukraine for Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And I'm sure that didn't sit very well with a lot of people in Poland. So how is that playing out?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'd say that the reaction is somewhat mixed. It really depends on whom you ask. Even on the right itself, it's you know, people just generally, I think, feel confused to an extent. And also because it's overlapped with our own election campaign, I don't think there's been like a lot of debate around the second Trump term so far. I suspect that post-election after May 18th and then June the 1st, maybe people will have more time to devote to that. But yeah,
interesting.
It's honestly, yeah.
it's not being fought out in terms of, you know, Trump. Because, I mean, Poland has been so closely allied and so kind of Western-facing for recent decades that I wondered whether that might be polarizing the election in some way, or, you know, like, where do you stand on Trump and so on?
I think people in the center and a large part of the Polish left, like, you know, you have to remember that we're basically all, I don't mean me personally, but almost everyone in Poland is some form of Atlanticist, right? So people in the center and on the left, I think they're more scared of this idea of Trump sort of abandoning the international commitments of the United States. But again, it really kind of depends and varies between people and various, you know, outlets and all that.
Right. Interesting. Well, we should probably return to Poland. I realize we've never done an episode on Poland before, not in a dedicated fashion. So that is something to be corrected and probably should take the opportunity towards the end of May or early June to do that. We would love to do that. Maybe we should do that episode from Poland and talk about the techno-populist synthesis that Poland represents. At least that's the working hypothesis. More on that in a future episode, because now we'll turn to video games. George.
Yeah, so before we were recording, I was doing my best Lana Del Rey impression, singing video games. I won't do it on air. Alex didn't realize that I was actually trying to sing this famous song of Lana's. But
I'm a massive Lana Del Rey fan on top of it.
But my vocal limitations notwithstanding, so video games. You know, shout out to our previous guest, Yonas Karatsez, episode 161 on gaming and politics, and check out his new game, Talos Principle 2, and his audio drama Gospels of the Flood, which is listened to that this week. Very, very good. Anyway, we've covered video games a little bit, but maybe, you know, we do sometimes dip our toe into culture. And I think this is your essay, Pavel, is really a good reminder of, you know, that this is an important cultural form. This is something we should take seriously, and it does have a promise, as you kind of frame it in the essay. What is this promise of video games? What is it that listeners should do? I guess I was going to say put down their headphones and pick up their controllers, but maybe they could be playing video games whilst listening to this podcast, if that's not too much multitasking. Anyway, what is the promise of video games? What do they potentially offer us?
Yeah, I think on the basic level, it's a promise that as a player, you will play a more active role than being in a traditional audience, like a passive viewer or listener, that you'll be able to actually do something and become someone in some significantly more real sense, even in the sense of being almost drawn into the structure of the thing at hand, so to speak, the game itself, right? The sort of the idea of immersion, which people talk so much about these days, is very closely linked to that. And the idea that in games it's somehow more easily achieved or maybe more powerful than elsewhere. This idea that you can actually inhabit, like, you know, a fictional world or whatever. So yeah, I think there are various forms, various instances of that, but the idea of being a more active participant, that's the promise.
And is this kind of contrasted, presumably, with, you know, passive, old school? You pick up the novel, you know, here are the characters, you don't inhabit them. You kind of, you know, you can come to know about humanity and the history of the world and all these times that you weren't alive, but you can't, the one thing you can't do is really be active and choose the story, those kind of choose your own storybooks, notwithstanding. So is that the kind of, it's that agency, that activeness, that kind of, you know, ability to not just in witness a fictional world, but also to inhabit it and to partly shape it.
Yeah, I think I was actually going to mention this later, but I'll say this now. There's this like an early seminal academic work on video games from I believe 1997. It's called Cybertext by Espen Aarseff, where, well, basically in the intro, what he says is that he seems really sort of annoyed, like, yeah, frustrated by the inability of postmodern literary theory to grasp the unique nature of the medium, the uniqueness of games as a form of art, specifically because what he says is that postmodern literary theory sort of sees everything like a game. Like, to them, works of literature are already games in the structure, so they are unable to sort of grasp the distinction there, which I think is you know, is very funny that this, the popularity of games sort of goes hand in hand with the development in culture theory, where people just start seeing everything as games to an extent. But this idea of more active participation is just very, very alluring for some reason.
Yeah, I guess if everything is gamified, then why not lean into this? Why try to resist it? So I guess some listeners might be thinking, you know, oh, video games, they're just, you know, unimportant kind of peripheral aspects of, you know, of the cultural field. And I would say to those listeners, think again, because I've heard this argument and I actually find it quite plausible that we're about to enter a kind of the age of the video game movie. So this is the idea that comic book kind of superhero films, which dominated this period, probably 2008 to 2023, have had their day. They've kind of run out of source material. They've overstayed their welcome. Everyone's bored of them now. They're not kind of dominating in the box office the way that they used to. And so instead, we're going to start to see increasingly Hollywood be a kind of video game adaptation machine. So we've already had some Sonic and Mario films, not to mention Mortal Kombat. I think there might be two of those, in fact. And there's a Minecraft film at the box office at the moment. But do you kind of find any plausibility in this idea that we're kind of, you know, we're gonna see Hollywood be very clearly downstream of the video game industry? So we're gonna see this swathe of American and hence global culture be influenced by these, you know, maybe 10, 20, maybe older video games. This kind of, like, I guess the prestige IP within that culture is going to then, you know, it's going to be spreading, diffusing through via these Hollywood films through the whole world.
Well, and also just to tag something on there briefly, there's the more intriguing prospect, perhaps, something presented by this film, which has just come out. I think it's available on Mubi, which I haven't watched yet. It's called Grand Theft Hamlet. And it's a documentary which follows two actors trying to cast and produce a live virtual production of Shakespeare's Hamlet in Grand Theft Auto online while they're stuck at home during the lockdowns. I mean, that's kind of intriguing because it's kind of a little bit of an inversion of the dynamic that George was just depicting. I don't know.
Yeah, I think these are actually probably these two examples quite close to each other in the sense that they seem to both stem with just a general sort of generational shift and the fact that, you know, playing games, not necessarily being a gamer, but just playing games in your free time is like a very normal part of your participation in culture for so many people of sort of my and younger generations, right? So I think this will just be happening more and more just because of that, right? In the, like, among screenwriters, right? You'll just have more people who are sort of more accustomed to playing games and drawing on them.
Yeah.
And I think what you can also already see is that in so many pieces of fiction, especially, like, you know, mainstream ones, maybe more than elsewhere, you'll get this feeling that either certain scenes or tropes or sometimes the plot structure is in a way, you know, video gamey. Like the way the protagonists sort of behave, it almost seems like the, for instance, collecting quests and fulfilling them, it's kind of hard to pin down sometimes. But you have this thing that some of the tropes and some of the techniques are just straight up taken from video games. And I don't think it's a conscious decision on anyone's part. It's just, you know, it's just what happens after the people who grew up playing video games get jobs in culture.
Well, I mean, yeah. I was going to ask you, sorry, to George, I was going to ask you, like, what does that mean to kind of ape video games, because I as someone who doesn't play video games like myself, I'm not exactly sure what that means. But I also have noted that the kind of tropes of video games have also entered into film criticism or just general discussion of, like, people talking about, like, a side quest or regen, which I wasn't sure, like, I wasn't really clear what that was until I looked it up and I realized, okay, it's like short for regeneration. Anyway, it's these terms that are used to describe the kind of the narrativity of life even, but are taken from video games, which I find intriguing.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely it. It's just becoming, you know, it's just sort of joining all the other media in being a part of, like, a general cultural vocabulary in certain circles, at least. Like, it's striking to me that these days when I talk to my, you know, my friends in the academia or my colleagues, it's just like people sort of switch from talking films to talking video games almost in a single sentence. And it's just a part of the same conversation largely.
Mm. I guess that's part of a wider kind of postmodern removal of the distinction between high and low culture, the kind of, you know, look, you know, the inverse snobbery, or the kind of preemptive anti-snobbery of like, oh, the canon, oh, that's, you know, that's full of old dead white guys, and you know, there's a whole lot more. And if you look down at popular music, at video games, there's something a bit suspect. You're kind of a bit of an elitist, and you know, that's not great, that's not a good look, chief, or whatever the right phrase would be. But anyway, onto the actual article itself, because in this you talk about one specific game, Helldivers 2, and it seems very much that this is a kind of unofficial Starship Troopers game. And this is, in fact, is a film that I think really has had an extremely, you know, extremely strong staying power. And, you know, actually we watched it not that recently, and it still, well, I was going to say it still stands up. There's probably some stuff that I, first time I saw it, I just completely went over my head. And now I actually realize how good a film it is. So this game, Helldivers 2, at the British Film Academy Awards, or BAFTAs. It was nominated for but didn't win the best game, although it did pick up best multiplayer game and best music awards. I guess there's something to be said anyway for there being BAFTAs for video games. But anyway, that's a bit of a side, I was going to say side quest, it's more of a side point. But could you tell us a little bit about Helldivers 2? Maybe for listeners who haven't played this, or like Alex, they don't, you know, they might not be gamers at their core. What is this? Why is it good? Why should we download this and play it?
Right. So first, let me just put like a little caveat here. I'm not necessarily sure you should play it. I think right, it's interesting, okay, because it fails in an interesting way, ultimately. I mean, it is interesting for sure. I'm still unsure whether I think it's a good game. That's a whole different question. Maybe we'll go back to that. But it's basically like a shooter game, semi-cooperative, in the sense that you mostly play it with your friends as a kind of a space Nazi, basically. Like you said, it draws on the same general tropes, same general aesthetic as Starship Troopers. It might be a bit, maybe more on the nose, a bit more satiric in an overt way. But yeah, you're an officer of this galactic sort of imperialist fascist regime, and you kill space bugs. But the game makes it very clear that the bugs, or you know, whomever you fight, they're not really as sort of either evil or you know, alien as they are presented by the official propaganda. And you sort of go on these missions with your friends, and you collect stuff, you progress, you're in building your individual space Nazi. Mm-hmm. And that's the general premise, so to speak.
So I think there is something quite addictive about games like Diablo 3 or 4, I can't remember exactly which one it is that I've played, where basically all you do is you just like, you click on the bad guy, and then they die, and you pick up their loot, and you get the experience points or XP, so you get stronger, so you get just the same, like the baddies get as much stronger as you get stronger. So it's basically just clicking on, and I find this, I enjoyed this game, you just click on the bad guys, and then you kill the devil or devil's daughter or whatever, and you know, sorry, sort of said spoiler alert. Anyway, there is something I think which is extremely, like the design of these games, the kind of the way that it's all about loot, the way that you kind of are drawn into this accumulation and this kind of, it doesn't take a neuroscientist to imagine that there's a kind of probably quite a strong dopamine like loop here, where you are expecting this reward, you get the bigger reward, the more, the rarer items, the more loot, the more powers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, this is a fairly kind of common kind of, I guess, logic of games. So what kind of sets out this game, Helldivers 2? Because it isn't just a click on the bad guys and they die and you collect their loot game. There's a few more elements in the article that you draw out which make it sort of seem much more like it's trying to do something a bit more than just that Diablo click and they die and then you get more XP.
Yeah, I think the main point I'm trying to make, the reason why I think this particular game is interesting out of, you know, all the ones that have been published sort of in the recent years, is that it is in a way a thing, quite an interesting critical commentary on what you just described, this sort of dopamine boosting loot gathering loop, in that it's obviously not the point. It's obviously a part of the satire. The point being, or the meaning that the game, I think, tries to convey through reproducing this loop, is that in this particular case, your immediate motivations, the satisfaction you get, the feelings you get, you know, everything that drives you to kill more space bugs or whatever, these are also the immediate motivations of your avatar in game, right? So the idea is that you basically share these immediate goals and the feeling of satisfaction and all that with a Nazi. And I think, yeah, that's the interesting part, right? Because it is, I think, to an extent, a commentary on on other games, especially other shooters. And there is like a point about how the usual focus on player empowerment and self-fulfillment and individual experience may just not be as politically innocent as it very often seems, or as games like to think. There's also, I think, like quite an interesting point about fascism itself, where this entire loop, this entire mechanic sort of serves to remind you that the motivations of your typical fascist aren't necessarily, you know, it's not metaphysical evil. They don't even have to be ideological. It's all about just, you know, a certain reward and incentive system. Mm. So I think this is quite striking. And this actually is also sort of, this is something that this game Helldivers 2 shares with Starship Troopers, right? This idea that it works on a very daily sort of like basic level in these people's lives. But I think on a more general level, what's interesting is that although you can see what Helldivers 2 does as a kind of criticism of other games and their approach to action, it also shows you that there is a critical potential in the very fact that games sort of have this access to action. They have to orient themselves around it in a way, right? So by kind of adopting another angle, they can become a critical tool by thematizing and problematizing action and like specific forms of action.
So what would, just to extend this thought a little bit, so to kind of problematize that action, would the idea be that if a game shows you that doing something is fun, i.e. if it's a game that's compelling you to, for example, be very violent, this should make you question whether violence is a good thing or not, or make you sort of understand that there could be some reasons why people would be violent. I'm sort of thinking about some of the shooters that are mentioned here that listeners might well have heard of, like, and my references might be really dated here, like Doom and Quake and Call of Duty, which I've never actually played, but I think that's more realistic than something like Fortnite. So Call of Duty, where you are actually in a photorealistic way, you're like shooting people who could be other humans, like in the head with your sniper or whatever. And if it isn't like that, please do correct me. So yeah, what is this? What can games do here? Because, you know, I guess that the more compelling a game is, the more that you're inside this character and you're actually, you know, transported, not just to reading about somebody doing something, for example, very violent, but actually you're kind of, you know, the shot hits the guy in the head, his brain explodes, and you're like, yes, that's, you know, I feel the bloodlust. Is that the idea?
Well, can I just tag something on there? Because it seems to me like it hearing you describe this, it sounds like a similar move to what films have been doing, I mean, since the 90s, where, you know, you kind of turn the critical angle onto the audience, you know, kind of going, aren't you enjoying this? Right. So Natural Born Killers, the Oliver Stone film, kind of a, you know, critique of media violence does this. Like, it goes, oh, you're kind of enjoying this violence that you're watching, but isn't this kind of problematic? So problematizes kind of the audience. Or even, yeah, I don't know, even Michael Haneke's Funny Games, I think, does something kind of similar. Anyway, it's kind of almost a trope now, right? And maybe video games are more effective in doing that and making you question your own agency because you're moving along the characters. But I wonder how different it is to something like Natural Born Killers in that move that it makes.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point. And I think there are two things here. And let me start with George's question and then go on to discussing how this relates to what's been going on in film and other media. I think on a basic level, what you said is obviously a part of that. But, you know, games, I think, are quite good at sort of, for instance, discussing the internal workings of collective actions. Like one of my favorite examples is, it's actually a board game, not a video game, but there's a game called John Company that's sort of basically about the history of East India Company. And it tries to, you know, by putting people in the seats of like individual shareholders of the East India Company, it tries to basically analyze the way that we're out of the individual interests of these capitalists. There's born a single body that has to act or we see as acting in a particular way, the sort of relation between this incorporeal body of the corporation and the individual interests of the players in a competitive game. And there are like multiple examples of something like that, right? The idea that games can basically take like a specific form of action and try to reproduce its inner workings, if it makes any sense. So yes, it can be very straightforward as a sort of a moral commentary on some form of violence, sure. But I think there's more to it. I think games are not quite there yet in terms of being like, you know, providing a lot of advanced and deep commentary on all these issues. But I think in principle, it's there. It is possible. Should I answer Alex's question about like how?
Please.
Yeah. So I think my interest in games as a medium or a potential art form is, I kind of think that the question about whether they can be art or when or under what circumstances, to me it's perhaps more interesting and important than either answer, precisely because they seem to me to pick on certain problems that are already there as like fundamental problems of other art forms in modernism and postmodernism, right? So basically, I think what makes this case and other cases interesting in the first place is that they all revolve around the problem of audience agency, let's call it, right? Like like we said, participation, being drawn into the picture and all of that. The thing is that in most other, I would say that in all other art forms, for various reasons, you can at least have a fantasy of avoiding the viewer to an extent, right? Sort of escaping the problem of the fact that the audience approaches your work with a certain set of preferences, presuppositions, prejudices, and all of that, and that their experience of your work is basically unpredictable. It cannot be guaranteed that they will take away what you as an author would like them to take away from the work. But again, in other art forms, you can sort of forget that this problem is there to an extent. Even in something like, let's say, architecture. There is this absolutely brilliant book from a couple of years back. It's called Nothing Permanent by Todd Cronin, who sort of talks about certain examples or tendencies in modernist architecture and how they were affected by this problem of having to put an active user inside something that you've designed as an architect and as a kind of an artist. But the thing is, even in architecture, and I think Todd shows that really well, that there are different approaches to solving that problem, but even in architecture, you can still have people who fantasize about sort of avoiding or escaping the user. No, by bolting everything to the floor, literally, or making models instead of actual buildings, right? So in games, the thing that interests me the most, in games, the problem is constantly there. In a very literal sense, you can't, like, it doesn't make any sense to produce a fantasy where you don't have to, to think about who's going to be playing. Or you can't, like, it's hard to say what that would even entail, right?
Yeah, you just build the world, but then have no one there, right?
Maybe it would be a film, but I take your point. Like it does seem, there's a Sartre quote: "Everything in football is complicated by the presence of the other team," and it's a bit like in games, everything is complicated by the presence of the player, but it's necessary. It's necessary for the game; otherwise, you have an empty world with no one to navigate through it, or a build, is I guess in architecture, you could just have the building there and no one ever sees it or goes in it or ruins its perfection. But I think with games, it is a fundamentally different because you need that agency in order for the narrative to actually to develop. I mean, one thing that you were saying made me think of Brecht and epic theatre, this idea that like one way that you can experience theatre if you go and see a Brecht play is, you know, it's alienating. It kind of stops you from getting emotionally immersed. It's actually like pointing out all these things, you know, breaking the fourth wall and blah, blah, blah. But that's not what games tend to do, right? Because that immersion is crucial to keeping people playing and to keeping the narrative moving forward. So how can games encourage us to kind of reflect on these things? I mean, is that limited by the fact that it needs to be compelling to kind of to get us to come back to it again and again? I don't know if that question makes sense, but just one thing you were saying made me think I should throw this in because it seems like there is that option's not really available in games as in the way that it is in theatre.
Yeah, I think you've pinned down the main problem at hand, right? I'm not really saying that because of this sort of intimate link to action or agency that it just allows games to do something that other art forms can't. I think I'm more on the side of this being a challenge and a problem that they have to somehow overcome, right? And in that sense, yeah, they absolutely have to find ways. Well, not around it, but through it, and to produce some sort of indifference towards the, like, if they want to mean anything, right? I think that's the issue. You want the game to remain a game, but if you want to make a point, you have to have a form and a meaning that's not open to the audience, right? Not a matter of choice for the user. That's just there. But then if you create, design a game where it seems like all the choices that the player has are just, you know, illusory or superficial, then this is just a bad game, right? Or even worse, it's a game that could have been a movie or a novel. So yeah, that's the whole issue, sort of how to do exactly that. Create a game which is still a game, but makes a point. I'm very much on the side of making a point, right? The objective meanings and all of that. So
I mean, it's a question of, you know, free will, but you know, you have to have the decisions mean something. I'm thinking a little bit of our conversation with Orlando Reed about Paradise Lost, which we'll actually return to literary criticism, not to be too postmodern and jump around between video games and literary criticism, because we're going to move on to literary criticism in a second. But I did want to just, you know, just to round this up, and obviously listeners can go and read the piece. But in terms of the kind of the final judgment that you make about this game, and you've alluded to it already, that it's a kind of, it is a failure. I mean, is it an interesting failure or not? Is there anything that it says about the ideological effective aspects of fascism that we haven't already covered? Is there anything, you know, by way of kind of, I guess, reflecting on this game and its kind of interest or not? And you don't have to come down on whether it's a good game or not. I think we can leave that to, you know, to the player to decide if it's a good game or not. The theorist can say whether it's an interesting one or not. But yeah, what is it, an interesting failure, I guess, is the question on this.
I think it's precisely that. I think it's quite an interesting failure in that, well, it fails at the point where, by trying to be a commercially successful sort of player-friendly game, it basically goes against the basic points it's trying to make, right? So if the idea is that you're supposed to sort of put yourself in the boots of this individual space Nazi, and if what the game is trying to say is at this level, the level of rewards and incentives, and if it's trying to show you that by focusing on this, you're not seeing the bigger political picture, which is basically what it's trying to say on a basic level, then there are some mechanics put into the game that basically like communal mechanics that let players as a group decide on the course of war and just, you know, the geopolitical situation within this fictional world. And this idea that at some point, in order to make the game more fun and more communal, a better life service game, as they call it, it basically starts presenting this war not as a, you know, as a kind of an activity you actually do with friends, a grassroots movement, right? Something you can absolutely and should impact. And yeah, the fact that it gives the players back actual agency within this fictional world. And that's so not because of any point it's trying to make, but just for purely commercial reasons, because of the perceived market demand, because the designers know that this will just sell and provide more ongoing income as a life service. That's the interesting failure part of it, in a way.
Because the risk would always be in trying to say something, but also have it be playable. Is that would be a sort of didacticism, right? You know, if someone's being guided too much through the game to reach the right conclusions, that would be didactic, and it might also then not be fun as a game. I don't know.
I guess a question that follows on from Alex's point here is, before we do move on to literary criticism, is you mentioned in the article Disco Elysium, which is a game that I have I have played after Nick Kearsey, former guest on the pod, recommended it, and I did give it a go, and I have to say I thought it was absolutely brilliant. It was surprising how, I think, quite moving it was, maybe even not to say anything towards the end, but this is a explicitly Marxist, or this is what you say in the article, and I didn't kind of realize that, but maybe I should have done. But is this a kind of an interesting success? Because this is a game that, as you say in the article, it's about kind of the kind of relationship between the intentions of an individual and the material results of their actions. But it seems to me like it's just a whole, it's like a very well realized world, and there are some kind of political questions asked more than answers given. And so I think it's a successful game because it's very fun to play and it's thought provoking. I don't know if it made me change my political view on that much, but maybe it did and I didn't realize it. So yeah, I guess the question is, are there any, to kind of counterpose to this interesting failure, are there any games that you would really highlight as ones that really succeed in making claims about agency, about, you know, about politics, and actually kind of follow through and just hit the nail on the head?
Yeah, I think that's one interesting example. Disco Elysium, obviously, it's become sort of a trope among people on the left to reference this one every chance we get. But I think it does a lot of interesting things also. And this maybe, I feel like the critics sort of miss this part of it largely. It does a lot of interesting things with taking the limitations of the genre and actually turning them into a part of the formal logic of the thing. It's hard to explain, but the way they approach, like the almost like the technological limitations of what games like this can be, and explain it within the logic of the world. It's that's quite interesting, and to me as an academic, that was like especially fun in a way. But I think the board game I mentioned, John Company, but also there's another one that's actually made by a studio that's at least partly composed of actual Gramscian, like academic theories. It's called Hegemony, again, a board game, but it's literally like the goal is to basically distill the very basics of the workings of class struggle in advanced capitalist economies and make it into a board game. I think this one is very underappreciated.
George, we're expecting a review of this game from
you.
Yeah,
maybe I should pick that up. I mean, maybe we should make Bungacast into a game, a card game, a bit like Top Trumps, perhaps. That's my first go-to. But no, I mean, I think it's, thanks for mentioning those. And it's worth reflecting, video games and board games that definitely have some similarities. And of course, Monopoly is probably the most famous board game that tried to make a point, made by a Quaker to try and show you that capitalism turns everyone against each other, but it turns out that we all enjoy crushing our friends and family under our economic heel, if we do indeed enjoy that game. And I have to say, I played it recently and didn't win, but did enjoy it, which is a very unusual game of Monopoly. But yes, as trailed, We do highbrow, we do lowbrow, we do all sorts of culture. We do, we're not postmodern, but we do want, like to cast our cultural net wide. So I did want to ask you for a bit of a vibe check on literary criticism. We've had a kind of Poland vibe check. We don't often discuss literature or literary criticism on this podcast, and I did mention the Paradise Lost episode recently. But could you give us a bit of an update on? Maybe this is an unfair question, but on the field of literary criticism, on the state of literary criticism today, is it in rude health and self-confidence, or is it flagging and needing a bit of a shot in the arm?
Yeah, I think the short answer is that it's extremely hard to say, but the reasons why it's kind of hard to say may be in themselves interesting. I mean, this is a field that's obviously, you know, divided by language and culture. It's really like it's hard to speak of something like global literary criticism. It's not really something that exists. And obviously, my own background is in Polish literature. But coming from Poland, one thing that always strikes me about Anglophone criticism is to what extent it's become, I don't know how even to put this exactly, but well, not decentralized, but almost disconnected in a way. It just doesn't resemble any sensible totality at all. It presents itself as a series of niches that basically do not have a huge overlap. I think there absolutely are some shared threads among them, like the fact that everyone's obviously interested in identities and the representation of identities and the individual experience and all of that. But this you could say about just any kind of criticism at all these days, right? But yeah, I think there's something interesting about the fact that there's just not a single coherent field of literary criticism. If there ever was one, it's not where we're at today at all.
What do you think would explain this? Because a few things kind of jump into into my head. Is it the kind of the decline of the strength of Marxist literary criticism? Is that a part of the explanation? Is it that there is no longer such a strong shared idea of what the canon is? So there's no longer such an obvious target of analysis? Is it a general fracturing of through identity politics of into kind of mutually incompatible and kind of incommensurate values, like maybe to do with representation or you know, move away from universalism in general? Are all of those kind of ideas a bit bullshit and it's just something else? Yeah, I mean, what would be your suspicion on this? Because it seems like there are, you know, this is maybe a more general trend, actually, just hearing you say it about literary criticism, maybe there is a lot to bring to other kind of films of academic study of this kind of fracturing and more of a breakup than a conquering of the discipline by any kind of one theoretical framework.
Yeah, I think all the reasons you've mentioned are probably true to an extent, but then there's also just the general impact of the market and the fact that actually another book that might be worth recommending here, a 2019 book, Autonomy by Nicholas Brown, which basically explains a lot of this stuff. And yeah, I think so let me put it this way. The reason that in Poland we still have something resembling like a coherent field of literary criticism is that it's largely a relic of the previous era, right? We still have certain institutions, certain literary prizes and awards and journals and festivals and all of that, which, they're not necessarily like direct successors like socialist era ones, but they are all rooted in the same general approach where the state sustains a certain sphere of culture that can more or less still work as a normative field, right? So there are critics who are paid to do criticism, whose opinion sort of matters in a tangible way. Well, it's changing very, very quickly these days, but for the most part, especially compared to something like Anglophone criticism, yes, it is a coherent field that's still maintained by all these institutions of a kind of a normative field. But the precondition for that is that we're, to an extent, isolated from the market. This is all done from you know, because of public funding of some kind. And once you abolish that, you obviously have just like separate niches that all just orient themselves towards the market, and where the shape they take is always dependent on what the dynamic of the market is, what the demand of the moment is. Does this make any sense?
Yeah, definitely. I think that's probably that's probably a tale that could be applied to other forms of other academic fields. But I guess that kind of the mediation through the market is particularly clear in something like literature, because ultimately it's, you know, people buying and reading books, or at least reading books, probably getting them out from the library on occasion, or downloading pirated PDFs, but let's assume more often than not, you know, purchasing them, and that is the market mediation. So another question that I did want to get your take on was the extent to which, and you know, asking this right at the end of the conversation, not at the beginning, and please don't be offended by this, but to what extent are video games criticism and literary criticism not so much difficult, but perhaps potentially quite boring today? So by this, I mean, and do correct me if I'm...
entertainment. We need the criticism to be entertaining too.
No, I mean, and if I'm completely off the mark, like I'm going to attribute this idea to someone else to get out of jail free, to use a Monopoly reference here if I am wrong, but to what extent has our completely kind of hyper politicized world, in which cultural objects become valid and occasionally even primary objects of political critique, meant that there's a tendency to reduce, I guess, all cultural production and all literature to politics, and then further to reduce all politics to identity? So friend of the podcast Maren Tom has made this argument basically, I would say, in the field of film criticism. So it's the idea is like formal judgment and critique get increasingly replaced by a kind of, so form in film, this would be, is that a good edit? Is this storytelling, you know, compelling? Is every frame a picture? All this sort of stuff. This gets replaced by a kind of checklist, like, has this kind of group been represented? Has it been represented in the right way? That two tick system, and you know, whichever groups is, and I'm obviously simplifying Maren's argument here quite a bit. But anyway, the point here would be, to what extent would you say that video game criticism and literary criticism might be susceptible to this kind of reduction? So the replacement of the qualitative judgment of the critic with the kind of political judgment of who is represented by art. Has this happened? And if it has it made has it made criticism more boring?
Yeah, I think the short answer is yes, absolutely. That's one of the main issues, right? And again, I think in all sorts of criticism, like perhaps literally all forms of criticism affected by this in one way or another, it's a more general, I think, shift where what happens when you focus too much on this kind of direct representation, right? The way that an isolated picture affects you politically or otherwise. You just stop thinking about works of art in terms of like a meaningful totality. So obviously you're no longer interested in form, almost by definition, if you only care about this one-to-one sort of presence of a certain thing or person or group or whatever on the screen, then you obviously do not care as much about the relation of this particular thing to all the other things, so to speak, right? So obviously this bars you from doing a criticism in a more form-oriented way, so to speak. I think, Walter Ben-Michaels has written a lot of just brilliant stuff about how this focus on identities harms not just literature and art, but also criticism of this art. Yeah, I think I would mostly follow for him on this particular point. It is a problem for sure.
Do video games partly escape this? My thing, I mean, this is just not an idea that's come to my head while you were talking, so if it's just, you know, if it's nonsense, do say. But like my thinking would be that video games, you know, don't represent things or people in the same way that novels do, because they have to be open to be a good game. So if the main character is like this or like that, then it's not there's always going to be a field of options, a field of kind of ways in which somebody can act. So that representation of anything is going to be much more open, because the more closed it is, the less of a game it is. So could video games kind of be less susceptible to this kind of reductive criticism that you were saying about, you know, Walter Ben Michaels has applied to other forms of criticism? Or is this, you know, is it still enough for this kind of form of criticism to see that a character in a cutscene is of, you know, this background is presented in this way, and so therefore it's, you know, on the shit list, this video game, because it's broken a rule? I don't know if I'm making myself clear here, but I thought something in your earlier emphasis on kind of activity of video games, and that you can become someone else, that, you know, and that openness, that maybe they could escape.
Yeah, I think mostly what happens is that the question about whether, say, a protagonist shares any features with me personally is turned into a question of whether I can recreate these features within the world of the game, right? Whether my avatar can have these particular features. Can I play, you know, as a sober person? Stuff like that, right? So it's the same question that just takes on two different forms. In one case, it's just about what's already there in games. It's more about what the game allows me to do, but the focus on this direct sort of immediate representation is very much the same in both cases, I think.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good way to put it, and that does make sense. So if, a final question, and this I think is a tricky one I haven't fully got my head round this idea of the kind of the novel of the internet. So this would be a novel that captures something crucial about the experience of being online in the 21st century. So I think it's pretty uncontroversial, or I certainly think it's the case that being online and the internet more generally has influenced the way that we speak, modes of speech, also probably partly how we understand and experience the world as well. Do you think this idea of the novel of the internet, is this something which I've cooked up in my own head? There was a few years ago Lauren Euler's fake account, Patricia Lockwood's And No One Is Talking About This, and Harry Kunzru's Red Pill all came out in pretty quick succession. And listeners may or may not have heard of these books, but they took in very different ways, you know, aspects of the experience of being online. And they were all in different outlets touted as being like the first, you know, the first real internet novel, the first novel of the internet. This is something which I would imagine, you know, 200 books have had on their kind of front cover or their blurb from some other writer or some magazine that's reviewed them, because this is what we want the novel to capture, this experience. And we kind of think, well, it should be able to. If it's an important human experience, then a novel should be able to capture it. So is this, am I looking for a novel, looking in a novel for something that I should be looking, I should just be looking at Drill's timeline, or I should be looking at a collection of short stories by Toli Tulamuti called Rejection, which I just read and is pretty brutal but good? Or should I be looking for this in a video game? Like, what is it that captures? Or going online seems a little bit bad. Like, I withdraw that idea about Drill's timeline, because you can't have the experience of being online replicated by just being online. That seems a bit
that's immediacy, isn't it? Yeah.
So yeah, anyway, this I don't know if this question makes sense. We're kind of, you know, chatting a bit before we recorded. Well, yeah, what's your take on this? Because I do want to just throw this out there, because it's something which has been on my mind.
Yeah. So I think there are at least two distinct layers to this problem. I think on one level, all the sort of the good novels about internet I can think of, I'm not sure they really, you know, about the internet in a way. It's there, but it's not really what the main point is, right? Like Harry Kunzru's Red Pill, I think, which is at least quite interesting. It's not really about that. It may be about a certain mindset that is partly shaped by the experience of being online or whatever, but it's not about being online. And I think it's telling that, at least with some examples like fake accounts that you mentioned, many of these works of fiction, they seem to hinge on the ability to sort of build the plot around around a very exaggerated version of the experience of being online, right? Because, and I think this is the first problem, being online for most people, most of the time, is just a very mundane, often extremely boring thing, right? Like there's mm-hmm. just not much to say about it. And the other problem stems from that, in that once you, if you manage to get it right, like to actually grasp what being online is like. And I'm thinking here about Jordan Castro's, the novelist, right? The recent thing where I think that I don't want to judge the book as such, but I think one thing he does quite well is describe on a basic level the experience of being online. But the thing is, I'm not sure there is an actual point. Like, I'm not sure that this particular thing leads to anything. I think that's like I'm just saying, really, I feel like I'm saying something quite close to what Sam Chris recently said in a piece about outlet for the point. But diagnosing the problem or you know, grasping the experience doesn't necessarily make good art. And I think in general, this really goes back to the point about identities and experiences. And that if your only purpose is to give an accurate description, accurate but superficial description of an experience, just at the level of what it looks like, then maybe it's quite insufficient to write a good novel. I'm not saying these are all not good novels. I'm just saying that if they're good, at least in something like Castro's case, I'm not sure this part contributes much to it, if it makes any sense.
I think that's a really interesting way to put it. And I guess the superficial description of you know, she sat on the sofa and scrolled through her phone whilst half watching TV, but this thing went on for 3 hours. Like, how that kind of that external description wouldn't work. There isn't, it's not a kind of purposive activity often being online. But
there's even something dated about saying being online, you know, because you have to like logging on, right? As if you had to open up your computer, turn it on, and then go on to, you know, log into something. And it's like, well, no, it actually, the experience of being online is, you know, being on the metro or at work and receiving a WhatsApp meme from your aunt about how President such and such actually is a pedophile or whatever. You know what I mean? It's like it, that's the kind of level of the way it's interspersed with normal life, and that gives it its banality.
It reminds me of that in Martin Amis's Money. He's like, unless otherwise stated, I'm always smoking a cigarette. Unless otherwise, like, unless it's made a comment that you know I'm not online, I'm online or asleep. But I do want to push you a little bit further on this, because I was sort of thinking as you were talking, like, okay, like, what would Tolstoy have written about the internet? Like, trying to think of like the most, in my opinion, like the most psychologically insightful novelist that I've read, at least in terms of the way that people experience like social relations and interactions of various different sorts. Is there a way, like, I'm just sort of thinking, like, if you had a book about being online, kind of teleported back to the 19th century to somebody who'd never kind of didn't know what this was, is there any way to communicate what this actually really is like? Or you know, if we have this technology, why not just give them a smartphone and let them decide for themselves? I guess my question here is there, although I take your point, it is a mundane activity from the outside and there's no point to it, it seems like it is important. So we should be able to expect novels to have something to say about this human experience, I guess is what I'm trying to stumble towards.
Yeah, I think your example with just traveling back in time and giving someone a smartphone and showing them in an internet and the question of what a description of such thing would look like back then, it's quite telling that what you do in this example is you basically abstract it from the entire social structure that maintains it and is in turn affected by it, right? And I think if you want to do that, if you just want to describe the experience at the very basic, like everyday level, that's like that can be done. And again, I think there are writers who've done it. I'm just not sure that this is what you're looking for or what we should be looking for. And if you want to write an actual novel about the internet, right, this would have to entail something larger, something underlying, something more structural. And at this point, it's probably no longer about the experience of being online in a way. So yeah, it's hard for me to imagine in that, you know, like for instance, with these realistic descriptions of being online, such as the ones in Castro's book, would you call them realistic? Because I wouldn't. That's not what realism means to me. You know, the kind of like the realism that we usually, that we associate with like the Marxist tradition and all of that. This is not that kind of realism, right? Because obviously something's missing. And again, this is not a judgment about the book. I think its merits lie perhaps elsewhere. I'm just saying that this is not what the internet actually looks like. This sort of an intentionally very superficial description of the kind of movements that accompany, you know, that are entailed by being online. But yeah, does this help at all?
It doesn't answer my question, but it makes me realize why my question's wrong, which I think is a very good response. No, I think that's right. That, you know, it is something, you know, you can't abstract it. So by thinking I'm looking for the novel of the internet, I'm really looking for just a good contemporary read. Maybe that's what we're all looking for. But no, thank you for indulging me in that final question. Thanks for continuing a conversation started in New York and joining us this evening, Pavel.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.